policies and behaviors, not values. And policies and behaviors like these may be great most of the time, but when taken literally and without room for dissent, they can result in the building burning down. They may rally people together, but they restrict progress up the mountain. We might say, in other words, that a dream team is like a family. Family members may not always see eye to eye. Some may not end up choosing to hold on to all the same values as they grow up. There may be a black sheep or two. But in a good family, a bond supersedes these differences. Members can come together for family rituals that bring them closer while maintaining their individuality. And this helps develop what sports writer Bill Simmons calls an unselfish culture. Like the Red Army hockey players, a family member who can simultaneously belong and contribute meaningfully is liable to choose the team's success over his or her personal success. This is the kind of team that can regroup and do what needs to be done whenever a new challenge arises. Like the Russian Five, or Wu-Tang, or Pinkerton's National Detective Agency. There's one final value that makes the whole dream team thing work. It's a virtue that we've hinted at throughout the book, and one that the individual members of great teams need to have in order to fully harness their potential energy. And this is what we're going to spend the last two chapters of this book exploring. Chapter 7. When Malcolm Changed His Mind. Part 1. 4-year-old Malcolm Little's earliest memory was of white supremacists burning down his house. It was 1929. The Ku Klux Klan had recently broken the windows of his parents' home in Lansing, Michigan, threatening worse if the family didn't move out of the neighborhood. They hadn't moved, but now they did. Instead of searching for the arsonist, the local police locked Little's father up in case he was the one who did it. They had nothing that resembled evidence, so the judge let him out. Not long after, Little's father was run over by a streetcar. The police ruled his death an accident. The locals, on the other hand, said a KKK member pushed him. Little's mom couldn't afford to feed all 7 children now that Dad was gone. She cracked. By the time Little was a teenager, she was living in a mental hospital. He told his school teachers that he wanted to be a lawyer, but racism stood in the way of that one, too. Quote, "You've got to be realistic about being a nigger," his English teacher told him. "A lawyer? That's no realistic goal. Why don't you plan on carpentry?" Angry, Little dropped out of school. He went to live with his half-sister in Boston, a woman who had faced several criminal prosecutions. She, too, soon ended up in a mental hospital. He started smoking drugs, then selling drugs, then stealing to pay for drugs. At age 19, he got caught trying to fence a watch. Little went to trial for burglary. By the time his white girlfriend sold him out from the witness box, and the judge gave him the maximum sentence because, as the prosecution put it, quote, "You had no business with white girls," Little decided that he hated white people. He had 6 to 8 years to let that hate fester from inside a federal prison. Little was surly and uncooperative for his first year in the joint. Other inmates gave him the nickname Satan for his foul mouth. He smuggled in drugs. When he couldn't get high the regular way, he snorted nutmeg, which has a cannabis-like effect at high concentration. He was full of hate. And nutmeg. An older inmate named Bembry took Little under his wing and convinced him that if he got educated, he might get his sentence reduced. Seeing Bembry as a father figure, Little took the advice. He started taking mail-in courses, reading books, and memorizing dictionary words. He started writing letters, and, to the guards' bemusement, he stopped cursing. Around this time, Little began a correspondence with the leader of a tiny new religious group. His siblings had recently joined. The group preached a mixed-up new version of Islam. It called for no pork, no booze, no extramarital sex, and other items of strict self-discipline. But mainstream Muslims refused to recognize it because of some of its new ideas and its lack of basic tenets, such as believing Muhammad to be the last prophet. But Little had no way of knowing that. He was drawn by the fact that the group's leader, a man named Elijah Poole, claimed that God had taught him the truth about white people. Thousands of years ago, Elijah's story went, Everyone in the world had dark skin. Then a disturbed man named Yakub created white people as a sort of primeval science experiment. They were all devils, the leader taught. And so were their descendants today. At first, Little found the story hard to believe. Whites had cited a similar story for centuries as justification for slavery and racism toward black people. Yet, the more Little thought about his interactions with white people so far in his young life, the more he realized that almost everyone he had met had treated him badly. He had an epiphany. They were devils. Little soon joined the fold and was soon trying to convert other convicts. He began spending all his time studying and debating religion. He got especially good at preaching about the badness of white supremacy and the newfound truth of black supremacy. When Little got paroled in 1952, he moved to Detroit to become a minister. He'd been reborn. "I don't think anybody ever got more out of going to prison than I did," he said. "I have fully awakened." With his rebirth, he got rid of the name Little. He now called himself Malcolm X. The group's leader, Elijah, claimed to be the infallible messenger of Allah. He claimed to have seen God and been given the duty of becoming supreme leader of the lost found nation of Islam. Elijah's nation required strict obedience and donations from his 400 followers. X had developed impressive speaking skills from debating in prison. The history of Yakub was a great attention getter, he learned. But the more he preached, the more he emphasized another message that underpinned the religion and the growing black Muslim movement in general, that the black man deserved self-respect. This message resonated with poor African-American males especially. It gave many downtrodden black men hope they desperately deserved. Unfortunately, the Nation of Islam's doctrine at the time dovetailed this message with militant violence and a disdain for anyone who preached racial integration. It was also pretty sexist. This put the group at odds with the growing civil rights movement in the southern United States. But it gave Nation of Islam followers hope nonetheless. X's sermons for this newfangled brand of Islam soon attracted larger crowds than Messenger Elijah's. With this knack for preaching, X helped grow the Nation of Islam's membership by 1,000 people in a year. Soon he was attracting 1,000 a month. He set up a Boston chapter, then New York and Philadelphia chapters. Before he knew it, he was giving speeches to crowds of 4,000 at a time. Elijah's bank account grew. He bought a mansion in Chicago, then another in Arizona. The little church was becoming a full-fledged religion and also a paramilitary group. Suddenly, X was overseeing legions of volunteer enforcers. They trained in karate and would brutally beat members who disobeyed Elijah. Things were getting a little out of hand. The Nation of Islam wanted their own country, a few states that could break off from the United States, or ideally, some territory in Africa they could run themselves. X preached that the black man should, quote, take matters into his own hands and use violence against the white government to get that separation. He decried the nonviolent civil rights movement of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the South, accusing King of being a puppet of the white devils. From his pulpit, X called Jews evil, Christians evil, and women weak. While Dr. King and his colleagues pushed for equality and integration, X and the Nation of Islam pushed for the opposite. They negotiated alliances with the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party to promote the thing that all three groups wanted, to keep blacks and whites far apart from each other. Unlike King and his followers, X did not believe that white people could ever stop hating black people. How could they, after all, if they were literally devils? As X's profile grew, he had a series of public debates with Bayard Rustin, a key member of Dr. King's civil rights team, whom you may recall from our Angelic Troublemakers chapter. X and Rustin represented the edges of two schools of thought among black advocacy groups in the mid-20th century struggle for rights. On the left were liberal types who argued for racial integration and even socialism, Rustin being on the fringe of this as a former communist. On the right were conservative types who argued for black business ownership and independent communities, the fringe of which advocated for a separate nation for black people entirely. The Nation of Islam's militant point of view on this was so far right, it was almost over the cliff. In their debates, Rustin argued for nonviolent revolution. X advocated for the reverse. "We are not to turn the other cheek," he said. Instead of joining the famous 1963 March on Washington for Civil Rights, X denounced it, saying it was a waste of time. "Peaceful marches were what the white man wanted," he said. When an airplane crash in Paris killed 121 white people, X called it a very beautiful thing. He called President Kennedy a prison warden and American whites who supported racial integration snake-like. When Kennedy was assassinated, Little told the press that he had it coming. Dr. King and other civil rights activists denounced X for this. Quote, "The hatred expressed towards whites by Malcolm X is not shared," King declared. "While there is a great deal of legitimate discontent and righteous indignation in the Negro community, it has never developed into a large-scale hatred." Black civil rights leaders backed away from X. White leaders on both sides of the political spectrum were terrified of him. The Nazi Party kept showing up to his rallies to support his separatist agenda. The FBI put him under surveillance. And angry black supremacists kept flocking to the Nation of Islam and training in guns and karate. And then, something impossible happened. X went off the grid for a little while. When he came back, he began talking very differently. "A man should not be judged by the color of his skin," Malcolm X declared in an interview, "but rather by his conscious behavior, by his actions." What? His followers were dismayed. Was this a joke, or perhaps a ploy? It wasn't, X clarified himself. "I believe in taking an uncompromising stand against any forms of segregation and discrimination." Had the separatists just taken up the integration torch of the civil rights movement? Was he going to join Rustin and King? That couldn't be right. While his fans waited for him to say, "just kidding," X kept saying things like, "I believe in a society in which people can live like human beings on the basis of equality." People on both sides were shocked. What prompted this? Where was the fiery preacher who'd taught so many to fight white supremacy with black supremacy? He was gone. X renounced the label black nationalist. He even started saying that women in his organization should have an equal position to men. He abandoned the Nation of Islam and became a Sunni Muslim. He declared that it would take Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, agnostics, and even atheists to make the human family. If we wanted to make a better world for oppressed black people, he said, we all needed to work together as a team. With this change of heart, X began writing newspaper articles with titles like "Racism, the Cancer That is Destroying America." He told the press, "I do not advocate violence." In another surprising turnaround, he also declared, "Whoever a person wants to love, that's their business." In interviews, X expressed remorse for many of his past views and actions. "Remember the time that white college girl came into the restaurant? The one who wanted to help the Muslims and the whites get together? And I told her there wasn't a ghost of a chance, and she went away crying," he said to a local reporter. "I've lived to regret that incident. I'm sorry." Malcolm X's transformation was so complete and so upsetting to the Nation of Islam leadership that many people were not surprised to hear the news when, on the afternoon of February 21st, 1965, a man stood up in the front row of the Audubon Theater in Harlem during X's speech and pulled a shotgun out from under his coat. Part 2. How does a person change deeply held views despite knowing that it could be the death of him? What prevents so many of us from doing the same with much lower stakes? This is perhaps the most crucial question in our journey to understand dream teams. Teams are made up of individual people, and in order to maximize our chances of those people coming together and making progress in the zone, we need them to be willing to consider and adapt because of each other's diverse perspectives and heuristics. We need this kind of flexibility if we're going to make breakthrough progress together. No matter how well we get along, if we aren't willing to change our minds when necessary, we may as well work alone. But what does it take for humans to become open-minded like that? Philosophy professor Jason Baer of Loyola Marymount University defines open-mindedness as follows. Quote, "An open-minded person is characteristically A, willing and within limits able B, to transcend a default cognitive standpoint. C, in order to take up or take seriously the merits of D, a distinct cognitive standpoint. Dr. William Hare, one of the pioneers of research into open-mindedness, puts it another way. It means being critically receptive to alternative possibilities, he says. Being willing to think again, despite having formed an opinion, and sincerely trying to avoid those conditions and offset those factors which constrain and distort our reflections. Open-mindedness is not something a scientist can see by scanning your head. And, as I discovered when I conducted another one of my surveys, which we'll get to in more detail later, we're bad judges of how open-minded we actually are. 98 out of 100 people claim to be more open-minded than average. By definition, of course, that can't be true. For decades, the best thing psychologists had for measuring open-mindedness was a personality test called the Big Five. It asks people a series of questions like, to what extent do you agree with the following statement about yourself? I am always prepared. Or, I am curious about many different things. Based on how strongly you agree or disagree with the questions, you get a score for 5 categories. Agreeableness, conscientiousness, extroversion, neuroticism, and openness to experience. The trouble is that the test questions that determine openness to experience are things like, I have an active imagination, and I have excellent ideas. Open-minded people generally say yes to these things, but so do other people. Openness to experience is about being willing to take in new information, not change our minds about it. Being willing to try a new flavor of ice cream is very different from becoming not racist or reversing course on a business strategy. Typical personality tests for openness to experience, in other words, don't explain why Malcolm X changed course, or why many people never change their minds about anything, from politics to religion to everyday opinions. X was open to debating his ideas with people who were very different from him, like Bayard Rustin. But debating over and over didn't change Malcolm's mind. Something else did. Let's think about the magnitude of Malcolm's change of heart for a minute. He went from being a violent, racist, fringe preacher to denouncing all three of those things. These, racial supremacy, violent separatism, and belief in the fringe leader, Messenger Elijah, were part of his identity. They were what helped him to get through prison and cope with the atrocities that white racists had done to him and his family. They saved his life. This isn't a story about trying a new flavor of ice cream. He denounced his defining life philosophy. He went from the violent conservatism of racial separatism to integrationist and peacemaker. He went from disparaging the civil rights movement to becoming an invaluable part of the team. If the Big Five's openness to experience isn't a good measure of that kind of open-mindedness, then what is? The answer is something psychologists call intellectual humility, or IH for short. As they put it, IH is a non-threatening awareness of one's intellectual fallibility. It's being willing to change our viewpoint without freaking out, and as of very recently, we can measure it. As doctors Elizabeth Krumre Mancuso and Stephen Rouse of Pepperdine University put it, quote, an intellectually humble person is able to find the right balance between dogmatically rejecting the dissenting viewpoints of others and yielding too quickly in the face of intellectual conflict. In 2016, Krumre Mancuso and Rouse published an assessment for IH that proved to be a breakthrough. It turns out that ranking high on their IH test is associated with a whole bunch of open-minded things. Openness to revising one's important opinions, curiosity, tolerance for ambiguity, low dogmatism, lower judgment of others based on their religious beliefs, less likelihood to demonize others for changing their attitudes, and being better able to detect the validity of persuasive arguments. You can actually take this IH test online at shanesnow.com/dreamteam/IH. Basically, this is the ability to keep one's own brain in the zone. This is exciting stuff. Tolerance for ambiguity, lower judgment of others. Intellectual humility isn't just the ability to change. It makes one more likely to correctly judge when it's time to change. So now that we have an idea of how to measure open-mindedness, the big question is, how do we get more of it? Part 3. In the Bible, a militant religious enforcer named Saul went about persecuting and locking up followers of Jesus. Until one day, that is, when he had a miraculous change of heart. While he was traveling on the road to Damascus, the angel of the Lord appeared to him. After that vision, Saul the Christian persecutor became Paul the Christian apostle. He spent the rest of his life promoting the faith he once ridiculed. Half of the New Testament stems from Paul and the people he influenced. The day Malcolm X's heart began to change, he didn't see an angel. He saw the hosts of heaven. In 1964, X was in the middle of a crisis. He'd learned that Prophet Elijah had been keeping a cadre of mistresses and fathered at least 6 children out of wedlock. He'd been abusing his power, taxing the members for his own gain. X wondered if Elijah wasn't a prophet after all. He was put on probation for, among other things, discussing this with other ministers. While suspended, X decided to do something that he'd aspired to do for a long time, make a pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca. The pilgrimage involves journeying through the desert of Saudi Arabia and reenacting rituals established by the Prophet Muhammad in remembrance of Abraham and his family. It culminates in gigantic gatherings of Muslims from around the world praying together in harmony. X was moved by the experience. "Islam brings together in unity all colors and classes," he wrote in his diary. "Everyone shares what he has. Those who have share with those who have not. Those who know teach those who don't know." He saw pilgrims of every skin color treat each other with kindness. He saw people who in America would be classified as white, who, quote, "were more genuinely brotherly than anyone else had ever been." And he saw brown and black people smiling and praying with them. It was like they even liked each other. And when he saw this, his heart started to soften. Study after study shows that we have a hard time scrubbing our beliefs in things, even in the face of information that refutes them. This is how we preserve our self-identities. Yet something interesting happens when we travel away from our identity-protecting home turf. Research by Dr. Adam Galinsky of Columbia University and several of his colleagues finds that people who travel become better at idea flexibility, or being able to solve problems in multiple ways. Travel, their studies show, also helps overcome functional fixedness. In other words, being away from our safe home turf makes our minds more receptive to rethinking our old ideas. Why is this? What's happening in our brains when we're in travel environments? The first thing that occurs is the same thing that makes it easier for people to swear in a foreign language than their own. Research from the University of Warsaw finds that our home language is more emotionally connected to our identities. But when we speak in foreign languages, we become psychologically disembodied. When we're in unfamiliar places, the lens through which we see the world becomes less connected to our precious identities. And this opens the door for something else to happen. There's a concept in psychology called balance theory that explains why we like or dislike people and things by association, and how travel can help us change our minds about things that are connected to our identities. Balance theory says that our brains don't like inconsistency. So when something is out of balance, our brains adjust to put it back. Imagine now a diagram of a stick figure looking at two objects. One is a big triangle, and the other is a big octagon. Say you're the stick figure, and you have two beliefs. You think triangles are good, and you think that octagons are good. You find out that triangles are big fans of octagons. This is great news for you, because you like them both. You are in balance. However, if you find out that triangles think octagons are bad, you become out of balance. You can't think highly of both triangles and octagons if triangles think octagons are bad. In our diagram, the stick figure has realized that triangles think octagons are bad, so now he's yelling, "Ah!" He's out of balance. This will bother your brain until one of two things happens. Either you'll decide that octagons must be bad. In our imaginary diagram, the stick figure has changed its mind and labeled octagons bad, and now he's saying, "Yeah, F octagons." Or you'll decide that you're wrong about triangles. In this version of the diagram, our stick figure has changed triangles to bad, so he can preserve his good opinion of octagons. He's now saying, "Phew, I feel better now." When we embed ourselves in places with a different culture from our own, we often get confronted with paradoxes about our beliefs. We realize that the way we have balanced the world may not actually line up. We're faced with the choice of either rebalancing the equation or decoupling the things we've associated, which can be extraordinarily difficult. Laboratory research shows that many of the things we are biased about, the negative associations we have with things, are the result of our brains trying to balance things out with our prior beliefs, not the result of rational arguments. For example, when psychologists put people in rooms and have them list arguments on both sides of a tricky issue, say, abortion or animal testing, people tend to list more arguments in favor of whichever side they believe in. But then, when researchers prompt them, most people are able to come up with additional arguments for the opposing side without difficulty. Quote, it seems that individuals have these counter-arguments stored in memory, but they don't draw on them when first asked, write researchers from the University of Pennsylvania. When we travel outside of our home environment, our brains can start to let go of the barriers that prevent us from properly analyzing the information for or against our prior beliefs. This can lead to a couple of results. Since we're less tethered to our ego, travel experiences can make it easy for us to change our minds about things. You can imagine our stick figure diagram now, including Russia and Russian food, instead of triangles and octagons. He thinks Russian food is bad, so therefore Russia must be bad. This is obviously not a good assumption, but it's classic balance theory at work in our subconscious brains. Once he visits Russia and starts to think about it, he realizes, hey, Russian people are nice to me, and the architecture is amazing. Maybe Russia isn't so bad, even though I don't like the food. And he may even take things one step further and say, you know what? I'm open to trying the food. And even if he still doesn't like it, he later decides, that's okay. He's separated Russia and Russian food in the balance theory chart of his mind. Visiting unfamiliar places primes us to decouple things our brains automatically link via balance theory. Traveling helps us to decategorize people and cultures and pick apart stereotypes from individuals, like the Eagles and the Rattlers did with each other during scout camp. This was the big epiphany that Malcolm X had when he went to Mecca. Quote, I have eaten from the same plate, drank from the same glass, slept on the same bed or rug, while praying to the same God, with fellow Muslims whose skins was the whitest of white, whose eyes were the bluest of blue. For the first time in my life, I didn't see them as white men, he wrote. It forced me to rearrange much of my thought pattern and to toss aside some of my previous conclusions. It was impossible to hold on to the idea that white people were all bad after hanging out with and feeling connected to so many good ones. The only choice X had was to either decide that Muslims were bad or that he was wrong in his generalization about white people. In other words, he had to break apart the elements of his balance theory loop. X's daughter would later say, the more he traveled, the freer he became. The freer we all became. This is where the prevailing narrative on Malcolm X's transformation generally stops. He traveled and, like Saul, he saw the light. However, the 2011 Pulitzer-winning biography by the wonderful and now sadly deceased Manning Marable makes an important distinction that most people miss and data confirm. Travel alone isn't always enough to change our minds. And it wasn't quite enough for Malcolm either. A half century after Malcolm X came back from Mecca, a young white man from southern Florida made a similar journey in reverse. Derek Black was the godson of David Duke, the head of the Ku Klux Klan, and the son of Don Black, the founder of Stormfront, the world's then largest white nationalist website. At an early age, Derek got heavily involved in the white nationalist movement, writing essays, calling into radio shows, and working to convert other young people to the cause of separating the races. By age 19, he'd won a county election on a thinly veiled white nationalist platform and embarked on a quest to get other white nationalists in office to combat racial integration around the United States. He was seen by the Klan and other groups as something of a chosen one among separatists, anti-Semites, and white supremacists. And then he moved across the state for college. He started hanging out with kids from all sorts of backgrounds, with all sorts of beliefs. He made friends with an observant Jewish student who invited him to Shabbat dinners. He just wanted to let me see a Jewish community thing so that if I was going to keep saying these anti-Semitic things, that at least I had seen real Jews, Black later told the New York Times. And then he changed his mind. Living among these other kinds of people opened his heart. He allowed himself to consider information he wouldn't have before, such as evidence disproving the erroneous, quote, science he relied on about race and IQ. I have these two experiences, and I have a lot of trouble reconciling them sometimes, he said. But balance theory sorted him out, and Black soon became a spokesperson against the thing he once campaigned for. Stories like these are encouraging, but certainly there are plenty of people who travel to Mecca or move to college who don't change their entire lives around. What's really going on when a Malcolm X or a Derek Black changes his mind? In 2016, armed with Dr. Krumare Mancuso and Dr. Rouse's research, I put together an IH assessment with some additional questions of mine to dig into this question. I ran a study of thousands of people around the United States to look at the ways that people with different amounts of open-mindedness live their lives. Predictably, my study found a strong correlation between being well-traveled and having intellectual humility. However, it unearthed an even stronger correlation that helps us understand what makes the difference between those who travel and change their minds and those who travel and don't. It turns out that people who actually live in foreign places are even more likely to have high IH than those who just visit. Living in a foreign country for 3 to 6 months has a stronger effect on IH than visiting 10 countries. This confirms for intellectual humility what other studies had deduced about openness to experience. Just visiting other countries and observing their cultures as tourists is not nearly as good at building openness as becoming embedded in those cultures. You can visit a new or strange place without trying the food, or opening up to the idea that the way people live and speak and think in this new place is valid. But it's hard to live somewhere and not become a little more open to the culture. Dr. Galinsky and his colleagues found that graduate students who had lived abroad were more likely to consider out-of-the-box solutions to problems in group projects than people who didn't or who just visited. Fashion designers who lived abroad produced more creative and successful designs than those who didn't. We might on the one hand conclude that open-minded people would be more likely to travel in the first place, which is probably true. However, my study found something very interesting that indicates a more causal relationship. Not everyone who had high IH had traveled, but almost everyone who had lived in multiple countries ranked high for IH. The key insight about becoming open-minded through travel is not mere exposure. It's the idea of becoming multicultural, being able to hold multiple cultural ideas in one's head at the same time, being able to live with multiple balance theory charts at once. Dr. Galinsky and his colleagues found that biculturals, or people who identified with two cultures, quote, exhibited more fluency, flexibility, and novelty on a creative uses task and produced more innovations at work than did assimilated or separated individuals. They were able to demonstrate that people who came from multiple cultures or who could identify with two or more cultures were more able to use lateral thinking, the application of open-mindedness, at work. And it turns out that when an individual's head is diverse in terms of languages spoken, that individual becomes physically more open-minded. I don't mean that one's head literally opens up, but neuroscientists find that multilingual people's brains do look physically different. Learning to speak multiple languages helps us to realize that there's not just one right way to say something, and that the way of saying something that we grew up saying can be less precise than someone else's way. This leads our brains to wire up a little more linguistic humility. As linguist Gabrielle Hogan-Bruin explains, the left inferior parietal cortex, an area of the brain heavily involved in the processing of language, forming concepts, and thinking abstractly, is denser in bilinguals than monolinguals, and becomes denser as language proficiency increases. This change in brain makeup leads to more emotional understanding of other people, less fear of loss, meaning more progress in the war between reason and the amygdala, and more rationality when it comes to changing one's mind. The more we adjust our balance theory charts, the more our brains change, and the easier it gets to adjust in the future. In other words, the key to intellectual humility is increasing the cognitive diversity inside our own heads. When Malcolm X made his pilgrimage to Mecca, he had already taken a bit of a hit to his ego. He'd been edged out of the spotlight at his own mosque, and he'd warmed up a bit to the idea that Elijah might not have all the answers he said he did. As we saw from his first conversion from drug dealer to preacher, X had the ability in him to change his mind, but his views had calcified over the years. His heart had hardened toward a whole lot of people. The trip to Mecca started softening it, but when you look at his letters and interviews and sermons in 1964 and 1965, it's clear that X's subsequent 5 months living in Africa were what truly opened his mind. After Mecca, he spent some time in the United States formulating new ideas, and then he went to Ghana, Egypt, and other countries in Africa to develop a more multicultural perspective. It was there that X fully embraced what would become his new rallying cry. The struggle for equality wasn't just about civil rights, he realized. It was about human rights. His Middle East and Africa experiences had greatly broadened his mind, wrote Marable in his Malcolm X biography. It was the romance with Africa itself, its beauty, diversity, and complexity, that helped Malcolm transform. X's philosophy on race, X wrote, changed after living among, quote, thousands of people of different races and colors who treated me as a human being. Part 4. Malcolm Little was 39 years old the second time racists burned his house down. This time, however, he wasn't surprised. He'd known the dangers inherent to changing his mind and breaking with the Nation of Islam. He did it anyway. Before he split from the Nation of Islam, X had already become an amazing case study in coalition building. He'd used powerful shared hatred of a common enemy to attract listeners to his speeches. He then used those speeches as a platform to get his ideas on the superordinate values of the Nation of Islam to a mass audience. Unfortunately, when his values changed, his former allies turned on him. After the house burned down, X moved to a hotel. He continued building the mosque he'd started after his conversion to Sunni Islam, and he went to work on his non-religious organization to advance human rights. It was during one of his public speeches for this that a gang of Nation of Islam members, possibly with ties to law enforcement who knew of X's change of heart, but were still afraid of him anyway, shot him to death in front of his family and friends. Malcolm X's autobiography would go on to sell millions of copies, despite the fact that a small percentage of his life was spent living along the lines of Islamic orthodoxy. In fact, people flocked to his book in large part because of his transformation story. And X's teachings would influence tens of millions, helping generations better understand racism, human rights, Afro-American culture, and the perspective of a people who'd been beaten down and abused for centuries. Despite his untimely death, X made a sizable contribution to the dream team that pushed civil rights forward. The movement needed X's cognitive diversity, his perspective on the poor northern black man, his self-empowerment and pride, and his heuristics for motivating and mobilizing. Combined with the perspectives and heuristics of the pacifistic Bayard Rustin, the eloquent King, and many others, the movement made historic progress. As we see from the history that ensued, civil rights needed more than a group of angry separatists to succeed. It needed moderates and liberals and conservatives to mobilize together. It needed them to link arms with people of all races to fight together as a team. It needed what Malcolm X realized in his most powerful epiphany from living in Africa. Separation is not the goal of the Afro-American, he told a packed crowd of 1,500 people at Chicago's Civic Opera House shortly before his assassination. Nor is integration his goal. They are merely methods toward his real end, respect as a human being. The superordinate group of mankind could only come together with that respect. The true believer, X wrote in his diary while traveling, recognizes the oneness of humanity. In order for him to get to that point, X needed to put himself in an environment where his mind could become open to the truth that the world was not as black and white as the KKK or Nation of Islam or balance theory would have him think. Dr. King said X's murder was a great tragedy and that it had deprived the world of a potentially great leader. This is striking because King and X had been philosophical opponents for years. X was becoming more nonviolent and king-like in his last months, but he was still more hardened than King ever was. In all those years, King had respected X, even though he disagreed. But over time, King began adapting some of his own ideas because of X. In his later speeches, King started preaching about black self-pride, an important message of X's that the civil rights movement had hardly emphasized at that point. Shortly before King was assassinated, the journalist David Halberstam reported that King, quote, sounded like a nonviolent Malcolm X. While King was a political revolutionary, X was a cultural revolutionary, says author James Cone. That cultural revolution eventually became part of King's political philosophy. Quote, Malcolm changed how black people thought about themselves. Before Malcolm came along, we were all Negroes. After Malcolm, he helped us become black. X's change of heart allowed him to help push civil rights leaders a little further than they might have on their own. And X's personal journey of open-mindedness made him a catalyst the movement needed. It's clear from the mountains of books and essays written on X and King that they each had a high amount of intellectual humility. They were both willing to change, accept, and hold steady when occasion needed. King was able to use that, and Malcolm X's contributions, to build the Dream Team coalition of people and ideas that got the Civil Rights Act passed. I'll confess that I'm a cliche when it comes to Malcolm X. Growing up, I initially liked him because of the part where he stopped calling white people devils. But as I dug into his story, something else happened to me that helped me open to other parts of his message and made me love the man beyond what was in my personal interest because of my identity. I would have my own change of heart about Malcolm X, and perhaps more important, about the art of respect and working together because of him. Buried in my IH data was the surprising reason why, and a key to developing open-mindedness in ourselves and in others that doesn't require the privilege or funds to travel across the world. Chapter 8. Oxytocin, a Love Story. Part 1. Fumiko Nakamura and her husband Takekuma would have never guessed at the time they were thrust out of their Los Angeles home at gunpoint that their son George would someday be a massive celebrity. The odds of this would have seemed remote, even if the young family and all of their Japanese neighbors weren't being rounded up like cattle, forced to live in stables, then prison camps. Truth was that 1942 wasn't just the height of Japanophobia in California. It was the high-water mark of anti-Asian prejudice in America generally. The law at the time said that Asian-born people were not allowed to become U.S. citizens because of their race's alleged inability to assimilate. Asian children born in America were natural citizens by default, but they rarely attained white-collar jobs or even worked outside of their own communities. A few decades before, California had been the site of the biggest mass lynching in U.S. history. The victims were Chinese immigrants. Since the mid-1800s, the Chinese and the Japanese had occupied the bottom rungs of California's social ladder, alongside Koreans, Filipinos, Vietnamese, and East Indians. Stereotypes were abundant. The year 1913 saw the debut of the fictional arch-villain Fu Manchu, brainchild of British novelist Sax Rohmer. Scheming, soulless, crafty, yet primitive, Fu Manchu embodied every Western suspicion toward the inscrutable East. And then there was Charlie Chan, a fictional Chinese-American detective who delivered ornate sentences in garbled syntax. Pudgy and non-threatening, Chan is frequently and profusely apologetic for the fact that he happens to be Chinese. Part hero and part stooge, Charlie Chan represented the white ideal of the deferential minority every Asian American ought to be. Then on December 7th, 1941, the Empire of Japan attacked the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor and awakened the sleeping giant that was America's war machine. A flood of anti-Japanese propaganda followed. Japanese men were simian, yellow, subhuman. Japanese women were either concubines, geishas, or maids, the unthinking attachés of their male overlords. On the heels of Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt made the mistake of a lifetime. He signed Executive Order 9066, permitting the military to lock up over 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry without trial or due process of law. Most of those imprisoned were natural-born U.S. citizens. Half were children. The reason given, unconstitutional on its face, was that Japanese Americans might sympathize with America's new enemy. But a congressional commission would later admit that the order was, quote, motivated largely by racial prejudice. White business owners were happy to see Japanese-American competitors rounded up and incarcerated, and California's powerful agriculture lobby was particularly eager to uproot Japanese-American farmers and replace them with whites. Fumiko was a U.S. citizen, born near Sacramento. Takekuma was born in Japan, but he'd immigrated to San Francisco at age 16. The United States wouldn't allow him to become a citizen, even though he'd lived in the country more than two decades and was working hard to provide for his family. Now 40, Takekuma, who went by Norman, had saved money to buy a home. But Norman's American dream was torn away when the U.S. military stormed his neighborhood. He and Fumiko, a.k.a. Emily, and their three small children were, quote, relocated to the Roer War Relocation Center, a prison camp situated in a virtual swamp in rural southeast Arkansas. George was 5 years old when Norman told the kids they were going on a vacation. He was old enough to realize that this vacation was not a choice. Inside the camp, he would play with friends outdoors while guards and surveillance towers trained machine guns on them. At the camp school, the children recited the Pledge of Allegiance. Little George could see barbed wire through the window. With liberty and justice for all. 3 years later, the family was released. Their home was gone. It was a devastating blow to my parents, George later recalled. The only job Norman could get was washing dishes in Chinatown. Back at school in L.A., young George was ambitious. He wanted to be an architect, or maybe even an actor. One day he might even go into politics, become a public speaker, get married. He was too young to know how long the odds were. In post-war America, the average Asian-American worker made less than the average African-American, which was itself a third lower than the average white. Young George had an uphill battle ahead. Asian-American Fortune 500 CEOs? Zero. Asian-American movie stars? Zero. Asian-American senators and congresspeople? You guessed it, zero. Race wasn't the only obstacle George faced. He had something else going against him when it came to fulfilling his dreams. Something he hadn't told anyone. Part 2. Let's pause here for just a moment. I want you to listen to something. The following quotations are from 5 different world-class athletes. I want you to listen, and then I'll have a few questions for you. Quote 1. No one can ever brainwash me to make me believe that Sugar Ray Robinson and Muhammad Ali was better than me. Quote 2. Bask in my glory. I am the greatest athlete to live. Quote 3. I run New York. I run this whole city. Quote 4. I see me being a designer. I see me being a model. I see me being a TV star. Quote 5. If you want to win, sometimes you have to have a difficult conversation with people. You know they are not going to like you, but you do it because you want what is best for the team. Okay. From these quotes alone, which of these athletes would you rather have as a teammate? How about as a boss? Which do you think is a better team player? Even athletes who compete alone are part of a team. The best boxers and swimmers and sprinters in the world have coaches and helpers and trainers and nutritionists and managers who help them break records. But as you may have guessed, the last quote is the only person on the list who actually plays a team sport, and coincidentally, the only one of these 5 pros who is particularly humble. Her name is Carla Overbeck, and she's the former captain of the world champion U.S. women's soccer team that dominated the sport in the 90s. The others, in order, are Floyd Mayweather Jr., Usain Bolt, Conor McGregor, and Ryan Lochte. Each is famous for his arrogance and attitude. Floyd Mayweather, incredible boxer, and he's right. He's probably better than Ali. He's probably better than Sugar Ray Robinson. But he's not a better collaborator. Floyd Mayweather may have a team, but he doesn't play well with others. Overbeck, on the other hand, wasn't just a star athlete. She's also a star mom, co-coach of college soccer teams, and an inspiration to her players. When she was playing soccer herself, she was notorious for personally carrying their luggage on the road, for being the last team member to hit the showers. Mayweather and the boys may be great athletes, but you wouldn't really want to work on a group project with them. In his book, The Captain Class, Sam Walker, the Wall Street Journal sports editor whom we mentioned earlier, discovered that every one of the world's greatest sports dynasties had something surprising in common. Their players, and in particular their team captains, had a whole lot of humility. For example, the Boston Celtics basketball team that dominated the NBA in the late 1950s through the 1960s, quote, never had any individual member whose isolated performance ranked among the best in history. In 7 of its 11 championship seasons, it didn't place a single scorer in the top 10 of the league. Yet it destroyed its opponents. Team captain Bill Russell, in particular, Walker points out, was a crucial collaborator, and he led his team to so much victory precisely because he didn't seek his own glory. Overbeck, when captain of the U.S. women's national soccer team, during its famous winning streak in the 1990s, posted only 7 goals in her international career, yet she led her team to dominate the world. This pattern of humility holds in rugby, volleyball, cricket, you name it. And we see this in the way that our Soviet hockey players interacted with each other, compared to their North American counterparts. The Russians described their job on the ice as being, quote, servants to the puck. And the player who held the puck was not out for his own glory, but to serve the other players. Nobody was trying to maximize his statistics. Nobody cared who scored the goal. Nobody was sad when the plan had to change and the crowd cheered for someone else's smart move. A team is more likely to become elite, Walker's research shows, quote, if it has a captain that leads from the shadows. And crucially, every dream team in sports, as Walker defines it, had open, talkative cultures in which grievances were aired, strategies discussed, and criticisms leveled without delay. Humility allows these teams to have hard conversations without blowing up. You do it because you want what is best for the team. Does this remind you of our friend Robert Diggs, captain of the Wu-Tang Clan? The RZA's primary role was to make beats and create an environment where his team members could battle productively and thrive. Wu-Tang was unafraid to spar, and when necessary, RZA put family before ego. Jean Lafitte and General Jackson, same idea, for a brief time. ULT and Web CT, Bly and the New York government, same pattern. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. demonstrated too. In each case, the team members sacrificed their pride and self-interest to the overarching goal of climbing higher together. This isn't just humility, it's intellectual humility. It requires being open to and willing to change when change is hard. Our complexity as individuals is what gives us the chance to do amazing things together, but we have to be willing to change our hearts and minds or it won't work. The more IH a group's individuals have between them, the better the chances they have of harnessing their tension, because they are able to actually adapt in light of new perspectives and heuristics and information. IH, in other words, is the thing that puts us at the top of the zone. In this final chapter, we're going to dig into one of the most powerful tools for making the human brain become more intellectually humble. We're going to unlock the kind of open-mindedness we need to become dream collaborators. Part 3. A strange thing happened in the 30 years that elapsed between the start of World War II and the end of the Vietnam conflict. The wage gap between white men and Asian American men disappeared. At the time of the Japanese internment, Asian American men made 30% less on average than their white counterparts. But by the time Saigon fell to North Vietnamese forces in 1975, Asian men in America were earning only about 5% less than white men. Asian Americans had become a fantastic case study in the American dream. Their collective economic outlook had gone from dishwasher slash suspected saboteur to white-collar professional. Now there were Asian American doctors, lawyers, professors, business people. Newspapers that once said Orientals had most of the vices and few of the virtues of the African now applauded Asian people's hard work and family values. In the space of a generation, Asian Americans went from the barbed wire of the prison yard to the marble corridors of power. Roll the clock forward to the year 2000, and the change was even more dramatic. Asian American workers had high-end jobs. They were VPs and CEOs of blue-chip companies. They were senators and governors, Hollywood stars and TV anchors. Asian Americans' rate of college graduation was higher than whites, blacks, or Hispanics. The image of the upwardly mobile Asian American became a stereotype in itself. While social scientists warned that racism and discrimination persisted, political pundits were already weaponizing the Asian miracle, lecturing other groups on what they needed to do to become the next, quote, model minority. The incredible turnaround for Asian Americans was good news for people like our young friend George. There was just one tiny problem with the political talking points, though. They get what happened totally wrong. Narrowing the earnings gap from 30% to 5% is a big improvement, especially when African American stats hardly budged. So what happened? If the mainstream perception of Asian Americans went from degenerate in the 1940s to role model in the 1980s, what changed? Had Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, Taiwanese, Korean, Filipino, Mongolian, and Malaysian Americans suddenly abandoned their own traditions and culture in favor of white American culture? Had they developed a new work ethic? No. Research from economists like Brown University's Dr. Nathaniel Hilger shows that the real reason Asians started to do better in America was not because they suddenly got better family values, and not because they suddenly started working harder. Asians didn't go from lazy to responsible. It was simply because America became less racist towards them. In a generation, the same hardworking Asian American doing the same job got paid more fairly. In two generations, he was getting paid even better. Meanwhile, the same Asian American student earning the same grades had better odds of getting into a leading university. Asians became outsized beneficiaries of affirmative action, at least for a little while. And a positively reinforcing cycle was created as even more Asians graduated from college and obtained top jobs. The United States was becoming more attractive to Asian-born professionals, enough to outweigh the risk and hardship of immigrating to America. So more Asians with advanced degrees came over. The children of Asian immigrants could grow up in a country where their opportunities were nearly equal to whites. Unlike young Malcolm Little, a counselor could realistically encourage an Asian American high school kid to hitch your wagon to a star. Asian Americans, some of them at least, have made tremendous progress in the United States, writes economics journalist Jeff Guo. But the greatest thing that ever happened to them wasn't that they studied hard or they benefited from tiger moms or Confucian values. It's that other Americans started treating them with a little more respect. But why? Why just them? The answer is the last piece in our puzzle. Part 4. Two generations after America started changing its mind about Asian people, a similar sea change happened for another persecuted group, gay people. Homosexuality has existed in every culture and every corner of the globe as far back as history goes. References to romantic love between two men or two women show up as early as the Egyptian pharaohs of the 3rd millennium BCE. Hammurabi in ancient Babylon and the Zhou dynasty of classical China. Homosexuality was celebrated in Assyria, tolerated in Persia, and embraced in ancient Greece. Then, in the 1st century BCE, homosexuality was criminalized in Roman Britain, as it was throughout the Roman world. 15 centuries later, homosexual behavior was declared punishable by death during the reign of Henry VIII. And by the 1800s, homosexuality was illegal almost everywhere. As such, feelings of same-sex attraction were kept secret by the millions of Western men and women who felt them. When our young friend George re-entered public school after his family's forced internment, he started to notice there was something different about him. He was baffled when his friends started getting excited about girls. How could girls be so interesting to them, he wondered. Now boys, on the other hand. While his friends ogled the cover girls on fashion magazines, George was drawn to the muscle mags in the corner, where chiseled beefcakes flexed, resembling your author, no doubt. Teenage George knew these feelings would not win him points. At the time, half of America believed that gay people shouldn't be allowed to hold jobs. More than half believed homosexual activity merited jail time. And as for high school, well, kids can be cruel. Think for a moment about what being a gay Japanese teenager in America in the 1950s must have felt like. People didn't trust you or think you were smart because of the way you looked. People would want to put you in jail if they found out who you loved. Your friends talked to you like you were straight, and the only thing that could be worse is if they found out you weren't.